This is episode 8, season 2 of The Bad Apples. Today we're going to talk a little bit about life with KDE 4. We are also going to talk about user agents, plugins in Firefox. We're going to talk about a book called Internet Forensics, fascinating O'Reilly book. And we're also going to interview the author of a really brilliant Linux Journal article that just came out this month in the new Linux Journal. So be sure to pick that article up, that magazine up, and we'll interview the author of one of the articles. And finally, we might talk a little bit about, I don't know, some other stuff, so let's go. Okay, so KDE 4. As I mentioned last week, I went to the big KDE 4 release event up in Mountain View on the 18th, and it was a really cool event, and I ran into some people I knew, just completely missed some people that I would have loved to meet, but, you know, just I didn't know they were there, they didn't know I was there, it happens. But I've been using KDE 4 as my primary desktop now for, I guess, ever since the release event. As I said on last week's episode, the easiest way to get it is just to go to the to enable the Kubuntu repository, and if you're running Ubuntu, which I am on my Sony Vaio laptop, you can simply download the KDE 4 packages and they'll install for you, and that's that. I did attempt to install it on my Fedora iBook, but I don't know that the packages are quite ready for that. I did try to compile them from source, but that was taking a long time. There's, I guess they're using a new compiler. I guess Qt uses a different compiler than the one that I'm used to, so I didn't really go the whole way with that. But KDE 4, you know, now that it's been out for, well, really only about 10 days, but you know, you're starting to hear a couple of comments here and there about, well, what is it like? How is it? Is it really ready for prime time? Et cetera, et cetera. And I'm one of the people who firmly believes it's completely ready for prime time. It's a fantastic desktop. I truly believe it's probably it's the best implementation of a really nice featured desktop that I have seen yet. This is a really nice desktop. It has got features in it that just take, you know, from all the best desktops out there. It brings it all together. It innovates. It brings a couple of new things to the table. It's really, really cool. I'm very, very excited about KDE. I have been excited about it for the past 10 days. Every time I use my computer, I am just enjoying it so much. Now, the first desktop environment I used was KDE on Linux. That was really the first one that I used. That and Fluxbox on my Slackware system. But on my Ubuntu system, I was running Kubuntu. And so that was kind of what I got introduced to Linux really with, was Kubuntu. And so I kind of have a certain admiration for KDE anyway. I really liked their implementation of the desktop. I thought it was really, really flexible, so I liked it. But with KDE 4, they're doing some really neat things. The overall look of it, of course, is really cool. And while I'm running it on my Sony Vaio, which is Intel Core Duo chip, so I mean, it's not like I'm hungry for any resources. I have an Intel graphics card in there, so it does pretty good job with like on-screen effects and things like that. So it's not as if though I'm really comparing it to, you know, GNOME or something in terms of performance levels. I mean, they both seem to perform fine on my Sony, so I can't really compare how it performs on lower spec machines. As I understand, the KWin, the compositing, the built-in compositing software KWin, is supposed to be a lot easier on the system than, for instance, Compiz Fusion, so that you get some of that prettiness with even, you know, older non-3D like hardware accelerated equipment. So that sounds cool. I can't really verify it or compare the performance, but what I can do is just comment on the way that things kind of interact with one another in KDE 4. And it's kind of hard to explain, but the there's a certain integration with the little plasmoids, the little pop-up widgets that KDE 4 uses very regularly. It's very interactive. It's very contextual. There are widgets, or plasmoids rather, whose purpose is simply to, for instance, tell you what the most recent drive that you've plugged in was and what its status is. You know, there's a battery level widget. There's a really beautiful analog clock that you can make quite large if you wanted to. But, you know, there are all these plasmoids that kind of, I don't know, I've always thought in other operating systems and even other desktops that, like, the concept of widgets was just really, really overdone and over, I don't know, everyone seems to be so excited about widgets, and I could never get into it because I could never really see the practicality of these little programs that just kind of are running. And, you know, it's just like, why don't you just start up the program that you're looking for? If you need a calculator, start up a calculator. What's the big deal about having it as a widget? And I still don't really understand the concept of these widgets and why people are so excited about them, except that I guess they're pretty easy to program in a way, and so you can kind of, you know, you can, just about anyone can make one, I guess. But the KDE plasmoids are very exciting to me because they're actually a lot more useful. They're more like applets and things like that. They just seem to be a lot more useful to the user than just these useless, you know, weather widgets and, you know, analog clocks and a calculator and a stock checker, things like that. Maybe for some people those are big deals, I don't know. For me, none of that really matters, but seeing like status of my CPU and seeing status of my of what drives have been recently mounted and things like that. Now that seems to be important, and they're nice as plasmoids because you can move them around and really configure where they are. They're not necessarily stuck at the top of your screen or stuck at the lower right-hand corner of your screen. You know, that you can really move them around and put them where you need them to go. You can even make the K menu a plasmoid, and you could have that anywhere on your screen that you wanted, which I think is a fantastic idea, because why anchor that to either the top or the bottom of your screen? Why not have it wherever you want it? I love that idea. Another thing that they do really, really well is they actually do a useful, they usefully implement the corners of the screen operating system. I mean, at least on Mac, I don't know about Windows, but at least on Mac, you know, you've got hot corners that you can configure to do different things, and that drives me nuts because people have different corners configured to do different things, and if you accidentally put your mouse in one corner that does something really weird, then you're just totally thrown out of your workflow, and that annoys me. So KDE 4 takes the upper right-hand corner of the screen, and it says that's going to be the place that you can go to add a plasmoid or a widget to your desktop. And that's just the function of that right-hand corner, which to me, I know it sounds really, really small, but it's just really, really useful. It's very handy. As far as I know, that's not configurable. I almost hope it's not configurable, but at least they've got a little logo there, and a little icon right there, you know, that at least it tells you what that hot corner does. Whereas on other systems, you know, if you put your mouse into the corner, there's just no telling what it's going to do unless you put your mouse into the corner, and then you figure out, oh, it did, you know, it turned on the screensaver when in actuality I wanted it to, you know, reveal all the windows that I have open on my desktop or whatever. So that just seems very useful. Very good idea. Please, people who are going to use corners of desktops, implement an icon system to indicate to people what the corner is going to do before they actually try it. I mean, that's just on a usability level, that just seems like such a basic idea to me, but it took KDE 4 to actually implement that. That's huge on usability, I think. Another thing that they do for usability is all their different effects. And obviously everyone, especially in the Linux community, you know, there seems to be a lot of excitement about the fancy whiz-bang effects. And believe me, I love the effects just as much as anyone else. But I also, you know, the usability person, my usability concerns in me, I like to think that we're doing these effects for a good cause. We're not eating up our CPU cycles for, you know, useless things, or you know, hogging our graphics memory for useful things. And it's also even nicer if we can really, really justify it to say that, hey, this actually makes things better. And I guess that's all just a lot of fancy talk for saying that I like pretty fancy effects just as much as everyone else. But the things that they do, I think, very right in KDE 4, the desktop effects, well, first of all, you need to activate them. I mean, there are some rudimentary ones turned on by default. You need to activate the super cool ones by either going to the K Control Center or the Control Center, or you can just right-click on a Windows title bar, and you can select Configure Window Behavior, and that'll take you to the Control Center. And in the Control Center, at the bottom right, you'll see the Desktop Effects button, and you can turn that on. And there are quite a few to choose from, so it's kind of like Compiz Fusion. I think it's easier to configure than Compiz Fusion, although, I mean, Compiz Fusion is super cool, and you can do all kinds of crazy, ridiculous things with it. This is a little bit more scaled back, or a little bit more reserved than that, which is fine, I think. So you go to the Control Center, you turn them on, and you can kind of scroll through the different ones. The ones that really jumped out at me, aside from exploding windows and things like that, which I like, but the ones that jumped out at me as being like an actual improvement on usability and interface design are things like, and this one is huge as well. This is as huge as a little icon in a corner of a screen. This is a big deal. It darkens the parent window if a dialog box comes up. So if you're on a program, and if, for instance, let's say Firefox, okay, and you go to close the Firefox window, and you know how Firefox warns you that you're about to close every tab in that window, so it comes up with that little dialog box. Well, in Firefox it makes it pretty obvious, but I mean, certain programs, you know, you'll get a dialog box and it'll kind of get lost in the shuffle, and you won't realize that you've got a dialog box waiting for your response, and you're trying to use your program and you're baffled as to why it's not working. So what this will do is dim the program window so that the dialog box really pops out at you and stands out. And that is such a brilliant idea. I don't know why no one else has done that. And if someone else has done it, maybe it's a Compiz thing. I haven't seen it personally, but I just think it's brilliant. I know Compiz will dim windows that are something, which I don't particularly love, simply because that seems like a very drastic thing to do just because an application is thinking. It looks very scary, you know, it kind of turns stone gray and you just think it crashed or something, but really it's just thinking. But this makes much more sense, because you're dimming the window so that the dialog box pops out. You can't miss the dialog box. You answer whatever question that the computer needs from you to continue, and then the parent window comes back to life and you're back in business. Great idea. Another cool one: blurring the background of semi-transparent windows. This is either, you know, you love it or you don't, you need it or you don't. For me, I don't think I'd actually use it, because one of the only window I ever make transparent is my terminal window, and that's simply usually because I would like to see what's behind it, so that if I have to remember something that I'm supposed to be typing in, you know, I can reference the name of whatever it is, you know, so it's kind of helpful. But I can see that people who are using the transparent windows, which I've seen people do, it's kind of nice, because that will blur the background, so now your transparent window, although it is transparent and you can see through it, at least everything's not so sharp and crystal clear, and it kind of gets, you know, cluttered and everything like that. So that's really cool. There are improved application switchers, like an Alt-Tab kind of thing, where you can switch between applications. There are window revealers, you know, the standard kind of whisking everything out into a minimized version of itself so that you can see what you've got open. There are thumbnail updaters, so that's nice. So if you've reduced something into the kicker, you can see updated thumbnails. There's minimizing animations, you know, which I think is hugely important. I mean, I know a lot of systems do it already, but I love to see people continuing that, because I've just seen so many users of computers just not even understand what minimizing does and where the window went after they minimized it and how to get it back. Animation really, really helps people like that, because at least they can start learning to understand that when something, you know, scoots across the screen and becomes a small little version of itself in a kicker or a dock or whatever, then that's where that window is, and to go get it again, you click on it. You know, these seem very simple and rudimentary things to you and me, but to a lot of users, it's kind of a puzzle that they have to put together. But there's a lot of neat effects like that, and I mean, there are the fun ones too, but those are the really useful human interface, you know, usability kind of effects that really caught my eye. There are also virtual desktop actions, so that if you're switching from one virtual desktop to another, it'll actually play a noise for you, and it'll kind of whisk everything over so that you kind of understand where everything is moving to. Again, it's just really good for human interface, I think, because there are visual clues as to where you're going with your things and where everything else is going, that kind of thing. So it's quite nice. One of the big things about KDE 4, I guess, is Conqueror and Dolphin and the symbiotic relationship of the two. I guess this is a big deal to a lot of people, because I guess people who have been with KDE since forever probably really, really, you know and love Conqueror. I'm not really one of those people. I mean, I only came in at 3.5. So to me, Conqueror, you know, I could leave it or take it, really. I'm not a huge Conqueror fan, I guess. I like my file manager to be my file manager and my web browser to be my web browser. So I didn't really love that whole dichotomy. So Conqueror is I guess now sort of a hybrid web browser is what I'm getting. And Dolphin is the file manager. So while Conqueror still also, you know, it's still Conqueror, it has all of its former abilities of jumping on the web, jumping on a server, jumping into your file system, things like that. You also have Dolphin for just specialized file management, which is what I'm used to. It's what I like anyway. So I was very happy to see the introduction of Dolphin, because I could just never really get used to Conqueror being two things all rolled into one. But yeah, Dolphin is a very capable file manager. It's completely, you know, it's what you'd be used to out of, I guess, Conqueror in a way, except that it doesn't do the web stuff. It just does the file stuff. But if you're using GNOME, it's just like that. It's exactly like that. Some of the great things about Dolphin and I guess KDE 4 in general, you know, again, the configurability and just the drag and drop ability of things. You can actually kind of rearrange windows, sort of the way that the windows are built, just yourself. You can just drag side panels over to some other place. It's just fantastic. It's intuitive. It is it's innovative. It's brilliant. It's exactly what you would. I don't know why it took. I don't know. It's just so cool that KDE 4 has come up with these ideas, because it's really, really impressive stuff. So, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a desktop scholar, I guess. So I could be wrong. Maybe KDE is borrowing, for instance, being able to drag parts of Windows around within that window. Maybe that's something that another desktop manager could do, or a desktop environment could do. But if so, I didn't know about it. So it certainly is a cool thing for me. And maybe that, I mean, to even go further, maybe that innovation came from Dolphin and not from the KDE people. But even so, Dolphin is being packaged with KDE, so there you go. So, you know, I mean, I'm not definitely trying to make a technical analysis of KDE 4. I'm just, from a user standpoint, from my limited knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes, from what I got from the release event, these are the exciting developments. These are some of the things that I've been using for the past week that have just made my life so much happier and pleasant. Another thing that KDE does wonderfully is the clipboard. So, you know, when you're copying and pasting from one application to another, it seems like a very easy thing to do. Apparently it's not. But in KDE, they've got their little clipboard utility, which I think is called Clipper, K-L-I-P-P-E-R, and it's anchored right down in the lower right-hand corner of the kicker, and it is, it's just a little, you know, it'll keep track of multiple clipboard selections, so you can copy and copy and copy and paste and paste and paste. And the most important thing about it, I guess, strangely enough, and I'm laughing because I still can't believe it, but in GNOME, it seems that the default, the way that GNOME ships is that if you copy from an application and then close that application, the element that was copied from that application goes away with the application. So if you're in a text editor and you decide to copy a web address, let's say, so you copy that, and then you go to Firefox and you paste it in, and you hit return, okay, so there you're there. Now what if you go from your text editor, you copy the web address, then you close that text editor. You go to Firefox, try to paste, it's not there anymore, which seems like phenomenally bad. And don't get me wrong, I'm using GNOME on my Fedora iBook, no problems with GNOME, but that particular issue, and I know that in, like, 2 years ago, I think, Lug Radio was, you know, just up in arms about the clipboard utility being basically non-existent. And there are fixes, you know, there are things like Glipper or Glipper or something, I don't know, something like that. So there are things that you can do to kind of do the workaround, but it's just it's such an amazing thing that's the default. You know, a clipboard should be in the environment, you know. So Clipper is really cool. was my point there. That's it's very nice to have a working clipboard again. That was very exciting for me to get that functionality back. But okay, so obviously there are people out there saying no, KDE is not ready for prime time. It's a beta. It's really, you know, don't go to 4.0, wait till 4.1. And I honestly do not see what they're saying or why they're saying it, except maybe that it doesn't have the sense that it's a distribution yet, which kind of makes sense to me because KDE is just the environment, the desktop environment. So yeah, it doesn't have all the applications that you would expect to go along with it. So right now, even though I am running KDE 4, a lot of the applications that I'm running inside of it are GTK applications, which it doesn't bother me a bit, so I've been doing fine. And, you know, KOffice and things like that, I guess, aren't quite ready for KDE yet, or KDE 4 yet. So in that sense, yeah, it's not ready for prime time. It is a 4.0 release or a 4 release or whatever they're calling it. It's a little bit of a beta-esque version. But I guess maybe I'm just used to using beta copies of things because that doesn't strike me as being odd. I mean, it's brand new, it's slick enough and cool enough that frankly I couldn't care less about what's not available for it right now. It's just that good. It's a pleasure to use. It's just so cool. If you have your K applications from KDE 3.5, they run fine in KDE 4, so it's not really a big deal that KDE 4 doesn't have the KDE 4 versions of those applications. And those applications are going to be upgraded to Qt 4, which is, I guess, the framework that KDE is based on. So they're all coming down the pipe. It's a matter of time. So I guess for that reason, yeah, I could see why people would say that it's not ready for prime time. But in terms of someone sitting down and using it every day, doing podcasts on it, doing, you know, little bits of video here and there on it, doing a lot of graphics work on it, a lot of web work on it, that that it's definitely ready for that. So if you're gonna, if you're a KDE fan, or if you're just interested in KDE 4, I don't have any reservation about encouraging you to give it a shot. Like I said last week, the easiest way to do that is to go to kubuntu.com. If you're running Ubuntu, go to kubuntu.com. There's a small tutorial, not a tutorial, there's like a 5-bullet-point list of what you need to do to get KDE 4 on your machine. It's simply enabling one repository, and then going to Synaptic or just apt-get install KDE 4, something like that. So it's really simple. It took me no time at all. I actually upgraded while I was sitting at the release event. I just upgraded right there, and it was great. So go for it, enjoy it. KDE 4, I think it's a big deal. I think that this is an exciting release, and it is going. I think this is it. This is the future of the Linux desktop, I think. Not that I'm qualified to really speculate or say, but this is a big deal. This is going to be something that people are going to want to emulate. This is, you know, other operating systems, Mac, Windows, they're going to look at this in a couple of months, maybe a year. They're going to be looking at something called KDE, and they're going to say, wow, why can't I do that on my computer? How did you do it? And they're going to realize it's the underpinnings of Linux, and they're going to come over. And of course, yeah, KDE 4 will run natively on Windows and Mac, and they had some talks about that at the release event. But, you know, I was very intrigued by this, because the way they were talking about it was, I don't know, I kind of got the impression that that could be your desktop environment on Windows or Mac. But in fact, that's not quite it. What they were really saying was that KDE apps could work natively in Windows and Mac. It's not that you can just say, oh, I'm tired of, Windows interface, or I'm tired of OS X interface, and I think I'm going to switch to KDE now. Obviously, you can still do that on Mac OS X through Fink Project and Mac ports, but, you know, as we've discovered, that's pretty tough to do, because finding the applications that you want pre-compiled for you is pretty difficult. You're also kind of running OS X in the background, so unless you really, really strip it down, you're going to be kind of running two OSs at the same time, and, you know, just not necessarily the easiest way to go. So if you're into KDE4 and you're still on Mac or Windows, just download. I know Scarlett last week said she tried the OpenSUSE KDE4 live CD, and which I'll include a link to in the show notes. She's loving it. She's working on partitioning her hard drive to get Linux onto half of her computer. So, you know, people are getting into this, and I think it's going to continue, and that's a great thing. Okay, so I want to do a quick tip, and it's kind of almost a moot point for me now, because now I'm back on Conqueror. So, this actually, Conqueror has this functionality built in. So that's kind of neat, and that's what I was used to. And then on when I was on GNOME for a while, I was using Firefox, and I'm still using Firefox on KDE, and that's kind of why I remembered that Conqueror had this capability. So this kind of, and I've installed it into Firefox. What is it? Okay, it's user agents. If you've ever been to a website that has been badly coded and insists that the only browser it is compatible with is, for instance, Windows Internet Explorer 6 and above, and maybe like Netscape 6 and above or something like that. It's always like some weird combination of IE, which no one should use, and Netscape, which no one does use. So these are just really badly coded websites, and a lot of times they're kind of like the government sites or local little government sites, or maybe smaller free email providers that you might have gotten caught up in, you know, back in early 2000s when you didn't know any better. Just little places like that. It just pops up in the weirdest places, and it just won't let you use their site. Or it will, but it just doesn't work correctly. The one way to do that is not to switch to Internet Explorer or Netscape, but to use what's called the User Agent plugin in Firefox. And the way to do that is, you know, just the same as ever on any Firefox plugin. You simply start up your Firefox. You go to Tools, and let's see, Tools, you go to Add-ons, and Add-ons will take you to a list of whatever extensions you have built in or installed already. So right now I've got AdBlock Plus, of course, I've got my Tor button, and I've got a user agent switcher. So I will try to include the direct link to the user agent switcher on the show notes. But basically what this does, so if you click on Get Extensions, it'll take you straight to the website of all the different Firefox extensions, you know, called User Agent. And you can select either the default, which will be Firefox, or you can also select, for instance, Internet Explorer 7 on a Vista platform. You can do Netscape 4.8 on a Vista platform. You can do Opera on Vista. And then you can even add your own, which is really cool. To add your own, all you do is you go down to the Options selection. And it brings up a pretty simple window where you type in the window agent that you, or the web browser rather, that you need the internet site in question to think that you're coming from. And so for me, a lot of the sites that I have to access require Safari, actually, interestingly enough. And you simply click on the Add button, and it asks you for the description. That's just for your use. The user agent, the app name, so that would be safari.app. App version, 2 or 3 probably would be good. Platform, the vendor sub, things like that. You can find all of that. If I've actually had really good luck with just kind of faking it. I think for my, the one that I did was just, I just put in like the basic information that I could kind of figure out. The one way you can get the exact information is simply to go to a website using that actual browser. So if you have access to the browser that you need to emulate, go to one of the sites that will give you back the information that your browser is sending to you. There's a couple of sites out there. Just Google, like, what's my IP, or what's my browser, or what browser am I using, you know, and it'll send you to sites that basically just mirror, they just send you back what you're telling them already. So do that, you'll find all the exact information that a site would want to see. And then more often than not, when you go to a site, you can click on the user agent, click on the browser that you know that they're going to require you to have, and as if magically, it will all work. Not only will they not bug you about not using Internet Explorer or Netscape or Safari, but they will actually function properly. It's really cool. So check that out. And actually, that segues really, really nicely into a book review that I thought I would do really quickly. It's not going to be a long, detailed critique of literature or anything like that. It's kind of a standard, you know, you wouldn't be surprised at all that it's a good book. It's an O'Reilly book, so, you know, if you've ever read any O'Reilly book, you probably already know that kind of the name O'Reilly on the book means that it's going to be really good. But this one I just found really, really good. And it's called Internet Forensics, and it was written by Robert Jones. And it is not one of those really, really huge O'Reilly books, like, you know, the Linux kernel in a nutshell. It's only about 216 pages, so that's, you know, a short novel, really. And it actually reads a lot I don't know, kind of like a novel. I mean, it's one of those books that I would just find myself, I just couldn't put it down, you know, and when I had to put it down, I couldn't stop thinking about what he was talking about. And it is just a fascinating discussion of what is going on when you're on the internet, what kind of information you're sending out from your computer, and what information the server is getting from you, what information you're getting from a server, what information you can get into and sort of uncover about, for instance, spam that you find in your email box, and phishing emails and things like that. It goes into really not only how to use, for instance, Dig and Whois and Host and little command line tools like that and Traceroute, but also how those interrelate to one another, which is something that I had not really utilized at all until after I'd read this book. I knew how to use all those tools, and I would tend to use them individually, and I never, for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe other people have the same problem, I hope so, I never really got how they related to each other. So this book really, really goes into that kind of thing. It has fascinating theories on why spam exists. It talks about, you know, the user agents and IP addresses and spoofing IP addresses, the different phishing sites and what they're using, what kind of scripts they're running on the servers, Perl scripts, PHP scripts, things like that, how to detect, you know, what kind of scripts are being run, and it goes into how to decipher, or not decipher, but really kind of like it analyzes some of those URLs, those big long URLs that you'll get from a company sometimes in a spam email, where it's just, it seems to go on forever, and you click on it and it takes you to some page, and you click on one of the links and it just kind of reloads that same page, you know, because it's a phishing site and it doesn't go anywhere, you know, just, it's funny things like that, and it really gives you the tools and the confidence to kind of follow through on some of the spam emails that you get, to kind of do some investigation. And I used to do that a little bit on my own, just because I was always curious about, you know, why people were sending these emails out, and could I look at it and tell what they were doing. And of course, you know, if you go to enough of those sites, you'll start to see telltale signs of things, you know, like buttons that don't work properly, you know, certificates that aren't even certificates, they're just icons saying that it's a VeriSign site or something like that, you know, things like that. So it's a fascinating book, 216 pages. It goes into all kinds of cool information. Its subtitle is Using Digital Evidence to Solve Computer Crime. And while it won't turn you into a Sherlock Holmes or anything like that, it really does give you a really good understanding of what's going on when you're on the internet, and what's going on between you and the different servers. It goes so far as to tell you what servers kind of are located where in the world, and, you know, what IP addresses are kind of cordoned off to certain parts of the world. It's just it's a fascinating read, and it was really enjoyable, so I highly recommend it. And of course, if you're going to get it, you can get it, like I say, from O'Reilly. Cover price is $39.95, but, you know, the best way to get an O'Reilly book is just to go over to Linux Reality and use his codes, because he gives discounts on O'Reilly books. So do that, and you can get it cheaper. You know what that music means. It means it is time for a big cup of KDE coffee. I'm going to go brew me some right now, and I will be right back. You go get yourself a cup as well. Well, speaking of authors, like I said at the beginning of the show, I did want to do a quick interview with an author of a really great article that came out in Linux Journal this month. And I don't know if you've seen the Linux Journal for this month, but it's got a lot of fantastic articles as usual. But it has a really interesting cover story on Phil Tippett's animation project called Spiderwick Chronicles, which used, interestingly enough, Macintoshes running Linux. Obviously, I felt like that was a pretty interesting thing to point out in the article. I mean, it was literally the subtitle of the article. It was Linux Powers the Spiderwick Chronicles, and the subtitle is Linux Software on Macintosh Desktops with Linux Render Farms Creates Paramount Movie. That is a really great thing to hear, because you hear about Macs being used in the industry, and while that's all well and good, the fact about Macs is, as I've said before, they're just locked down. They are not for the user, they are for the companies. And as a video editor, I know quite well that there's a big need even in just video editing, and I don't do any kind of animation, but there's a huge need for rendering. And the more computers you can have, you can cluster together to work on that render job, the better. And Final Cut Pro, the premier editing software on the Mac, simply does not allow you to do that unless you buy multiple copies of Final Cut Pro, which would set you back thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. There are obviously free render solutions out there for Linux, but because Final Cut will not speak to any of those, they are useless. Whereas they will talk to systems like Maya and other Autodesk solutions. So it's a ridiculous situation on the software side of things, and it's not because the technology isn't there, it's just because it's not being provided. So the fact that Phil Tippett, who is an animator who started out at ILM, at Industrial Light and Magic, the guys who did Star Wars, and now he's he's got his own thing now. He's doing this big movie for Paramount Studios, which, you know, is a pity that he's has to do something for a big corporation like that, but, you know, got to get paid. And so they're using Linux, and now they're using a lot of proprietary Linux applications, things that they've written in-house specifically to make that movie. So they're proprietary in the sense that they wrote them themselves. I don't know if they would be free, but I, you know, no one's offering them. But they are using certain things that you and I can get as well, CinePaint, which is sort of the 16-bit version of GIMP, things like that. So it's a really cool article to read, and in fact, it has nothing to do with the article I was actually going to point out in the beginning. Although maybe I will try to interview the author of that Linux, the Spiderwick Chronicles article, Robin Rowe. I don't know who he or she is necessarily, but it sounds like an interesting person to talk to, nevertheless. No, the article I was thinking about really is on page 93. Which, if you think about it, is a great page to be on. It's right at the end of the art of the magazine, so people are probably gonna get to it, you know, kind of when they're, you know, one of those, you know, you've been through the whole magazine, you're ready for that last, really, you know, standout article, and this guy really delivers. It's called Video Codecs and the Free World. It's how codecs are hurting multimedia, how Linux is dealing with it, and why codecs can save it. The article was written by me, and you can certainly pick up Linux Journal and read that article. It's a fascinating article, if I do say so myself. It's about video codecs, a subject very close to my heart, or rather very thorny in my side. And it's a good analysis, I think, of the industry, of how it relates to Linux, and of where I think it needs to go, and where I hope it will go. So you can certainly pick up Linux Journal, read that article. Let me know what you think if you do read it. It's a little bit of a niche article. I mean, it's pretty dry. I reread it. You know, I wrote it months ago and I reread it, and I definitely I definitely wrote a technical article, but it's nevertheless very informative, and goes over a lot of important points and a lot of interesting points, I think. So let me know, you know, drop me a line if you read it, and let me know what you think. Here is a promo for the Southern California Linux Expo.
By now, you've probably heard about Linux, but whether you're a pro or have barely heard the word, scale. The Southern California Linux Expo has something for you. Scale 6X will have over 50 speakers covering the hottest topics in open source software and more than 75 booths this year representing a wide range of commercial products and nonprofit organizations. Don't forget Friday's special sessions with Docs, open source software in the healthcare industry, the Women in Open Source Conference, and new this year is the Open Source Software in Education Conference. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2008 at the Westin LAX Hotel in Los Angeles, California. For more information and to register for the expo, visit socallinuxexpo.org, use promo code CAST, that's C-A-S-T, for 40% off of your registration. We'll see you at Scale.
So with Scale coming up, and a lot of great speakers are going to be there. I kind of thought of, and actually even since I went to the KDE release event, I was at a hotel that night, jumping online on a public wireless network that, you know, anyone in the hotel could get onto freely. It brought to mind once again how really kind of insecure sometimes we can be with our digital little information boxes. We take our notebooks everywhere, at least certainly I do, and one of the things that we kind of take for granted is that we have, you know, we get very excited when we find an open network, you know, and we jump right on and start surfing the net. Now on Linux, as the guys over at Going Linux are basically, I guess, proving sacrificially, by refusing to set up a firewall, or at least Tom is. But what they are showing is that on Linux we're a lot more secure than a lot of other systems. But trust me, you know, even if you're on, well, I mean, obviously if you're on Windows, I mean, that goes without saying, but even if you're on Mac, and even if you are on Linux, the threat of, or the potential of being on a network, you know, is, it puts you into a situation that you might not, that you're just not in at home behind, you know, a firewall and behind a router and on a, you know, password, a heavily password protected and maybe a Mac filtered and whatever you're doing to your network, you know, it's a lot safer at home. But we get so excited sometimes about an open network or free Wi-Fi, we just jump right on, giving nary a thought to who else might be on the network. Now, actually, I don't. The one thing, there are two things I'd like to talk about. One are live CDs, which obviously, if you're listening to this show, you probably know what a live CD is. It's a Linux distribution that you put into your CD drive. You boot up your computer, and it boots off the CD drive, and it just runs off the CD, and it doesn't install itself on your hard drive, and you just use that as so. And obviously there are variations on that theme, because you could always do this with a USB stick. So you could, I know that if you donate a certain amount to the Free Software Foundation, for instance, you get a free USB, or they send you a USB stick with GNU stuff on there. That would be perfect. You know, you could take that, put Zip Slack on it, or Mandriva or something, you know, one of those damn small Linux, one of those small guys that kind of make it easy to install it onto a USB stick and boot from there. Point is that you can go onto a network, boot it under your CD, and surf the internet and do all of the things that you would normally do without any fear of anyone getting into your system, because if anyone did get into your system, they're only on a live CD, which is basically pretty tough to, I mean, they can't do anything, you know, it's just a live CD, there's nothing writable there, it's a read-only system, so that would be great. Now, obviously, if you're doing banking or something, that's not going to help you, because you're still on the banking site, and you're still sending your information, but in terms of them getting to your actual personal data, not very likely. Another thing that you can do is use something called Tripwire. Now, Tripwire is a software package that you would use before you go to the convention or to the hotel or to the university or whatever, wherever you're going that you anticipate going on to a public network without really knowing who else is on it, and you know, you're exposing your system basically to unknown variables. And Tripwire is basically a way to scan your system and see what is on it and where everything is. It just kind of takes, I guess, a snapshot sort of your system as it is before you take your computer into this unknown environment. And then when you get back from the unknown environment, you use Tripwire to analyze your system, and it will tell you basically what has changed or what has if anything has changed. And if it's a serious change that you know that you did not make, you can assume that or if there's a picture of an aardvark on your desktop that you have no idea how it got there, you'd probably see that. But maybe it's a small picture of an aardvark, and the Tripwire would reveal that to you because it wasn't there before, it's there now. Something obviously happened between home, unknown environment, and back home. Now, there are interesting variations on that idea, because Tripwire is just as far as I know, it only scans and kind of takes... It kind of audits your system, kind of figures out what is there. Now, there is a company called Pharonix, which is Pharonics. I don't use them personally, but I use them at work all the time, because it is... I have a lot of clients that need things done, and... what Pharonix does, they make a product called Deep Freeze, which they make it for every system, you know, Linux, Mac, okay, I don't, probably Windows as well, I don't know, but at least Linux and Mac for sure. And it's called Deep Freeze, and so basically what you do is you boot into your system with Deep Freeze turned on. And it's frozen. Your system is in a frozen state, essentially. Or you can think of it as being frozen. I mean, it works. It's just... It's really fantastic, actually. You can do everything you want to do. You can save to the hard drive, use all your programs, throw things away, move things, reconfigure. Whatever your client needs you to do, you can do on your system. And then... what I do, the way that I use it, is I dump all of the client's information off of that system, you know, so we're working from an external hard drive or something, because once you reboot your system, everything that you've done, everything that you've gone in and kind of screwed up, is forgotten. So every time you reboot, it reboots into that point that you froze the system. Now, you can obviously turn that Deep Freeze off and on. I mean, you wouldn't want that to be your normal computer, because then everything you did would go away after you rebooted. But in terms of ensuring that people aren't destroying your system one way, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, I mean, my clients don't come in to destroy my system, but they come in for work to be done on video and photos and things like that, graphic design and things like that. And just to give greatest flexibility, the computer is at their can do anything, and I don't have to worry about my default environment being messed up, because all I have to do is reboot and I'll regain everything. So that's kind of a similar idea as Tripwire in a way, but a little bit different. So those are three options that you might want to consider. I know that Tripwire is, I'm pretty sure that's free. Pharonix, I'm pretty sure costs, and like I say, I don't use it myself. I don't know if they're more of a big business kind of company or if they actually sell individual licenses. I'm not sure. I think I've seen their ads in maybe Linux Journal or maybe Linux Format. I don't know. I remember seeing an ad for them. Their logo is like a polar bear or something, so you kind of can't miss it. But live CDs, obviously, I mean, that's the one that I use. That's what I use the most of all. If I'm going to be on a public network and I've never been there, you know, if it's just just out at a big tech conference or something, more often than not, I'll just boot into a live CD and use that, because that really diminishes basically just the availability. My personal information isn't even on that system. So if anyone gets into the system via the network, there's really nothing there that they can get that I don't want them to have, and there's nothing that they can do that just can't be, you know, rebooted and put right back, you know, booting from the CD. So some choices for you, some options. I'll try to put some of those in the show notes. Let's move on. And speaking of aardvarks on desktops, let's listen to a promo for Going Linux.
Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Going Linux is a podcast for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done. Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows, or if you're just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with practical, day-to-day advice on how to use the operating system. Our goal is to help make the Linux experience easy for you. In the user experience episodes of Going Linux, we take a couple of months to cover a topic. During the first month, we cover general information and areas of interest to switchers. During month two, we cover the topic from a more advanced perspective for users of Linux trying to build their confidence and competence with the operating system. Between user experience episodes, we cover listener feedback and answer listener questions. Our website is goinglinux.com. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, that's Going Linux. So if you haven't checked that out, you should really go over to goinglinux.com and catch up. They're only, like I said a couple of weeks ago, they're only a couple of, they're maybe 20 episodes in. There's plenty of time to catch up. It's a lot of good listening. Their whole intent, as their promo states, is to help people ease their way into Linux, I guess. But they do it in a really, really well-structured way. And they have an introductory, a lightweight episode on a subject. So they have some listener feedback and kind of some conversation between the two hosts, Larry and Tom. And then they have the advanced episode and then more feedback. And that's what they do. And they spend 2 months on each subject. And they're just going over some really cool topics, and it's really just, no matter what you know about Linux, you're going to learn stuff on this show. It's really, really well done. And the really nice thing about it too is that one of the guys is KDE and the other guy is GNOME, and it's, I believe it's Tom that is GNOME and Larry that is KDE, and I'm sure I got that wrong, so there you go. 50-50 chance, right? So, check out Going Linux. It's a really great show. And let's see. So there are, I'm wrapping it up now. I have to talk a little bit about the shuttle. You've probably seen it if you go to any of the tech sites, or if you listen to, any of the shows, Linux Outlaws, they talked about it. There's a new PC being offered, or that will be offered. I've been scouring the internet for it hungrily, but it's nowhere to be found yet. Just screenshots, or not screenshots, but pictures of the actual PC. But it will be sold, apparently, by a company called Shuttle, which I'd never heard of before, but apparently they're a PC maker. And this is a small, compact PC that it's a desktop, it's not a notebook. And they're phenomenally designed. I mean, I feel like I'm being pretty superficial this episode with all my talk about the nice eye candy in KDE and the wonderful design of these Shuttle PCs. I think it's called the Shuttle K PC. And the K, I wonder about that. I mean, I really wonder if that means KDE PC or what. Because it is, of course, otherwise I wouldn't be mentioning it probably, it's coming preloaded with Linux. And they don't specify in any of the hype what Linux distribution it's going to ship with, what desktop environment, or anything. It's just, it's been shots of the actual PC, and it's just a tower form factor, kind of, but it's really more of a I can't think of really how to describe it. I mean, it's not a cube, and the term breadbox doesn't sound very complimentary, but that's kind of what it looks like. It's kind of, you know, it's short and kind of a little bit long, and it's just really, really, it's really unique looking. It just looks super cool, and it's not like one of those things that's trying to be like a Mac. It's not trying to be, you know, super high tech. It's just like this really kind of minimalistic and kind of simple but really attractive outside design that strikes me as just being a perfect little desktop to put, you know. I mean, I had to get rid of a couple of my towers recently simply because I'm needing to upgrade some of the computers. So I'm kind of in the market for something with a more modern chip in it anyway. I'll probably have to end up getting something more powerful than the Shuttle KPC, but it's $200. You can also get a $99 version so that you can kind of make your own, which is really tempting. I just know myself, I'm probably going to have to get a tower that is really, really expandable. I mean, that's kind of the way I lean when I'm looking for a tower, but this one is really nice looking. And the cool thing is that they've got a couple of different designs. There's a blue one with, I don't know, a happy face on it, or a red one with a flower on it, and then the white one with a coffee cup on it. Need I say more? That is it. The show is over. I have talked a lot. Hopefully some of it was informative. I know that the KDE segment probably was just a lot of just drivel, but that's how I feel about KDE, so, you know, check it out for sure. It's a really cool desktop environment. And if you need to contact me, or Gort, or Skirlet, you can reach us at gort.klaatu@thebadapples.info. If you are wondering where Gort is, yes, he is still alive. He is, from what I understand, still in this solar system, but he still has not loaded a computer up with Linux, and so obviously we can't let him back on the show. So, but he's contacted me, and he's told me that he's digging out a PC, an old PC that he's got, and he's gonna put Linux onto it. Probably a very lightweight one because it is an old PC, so we'll see how it goes. I also recommend the Dragonfly BSD to him, simply because I've been playing around with that lately and have had really good luck with that. So, something will happen, and he will get back on the show. And, so it's gort.klaatu@gmail.com, or you can always visit our website, thebadapples.info. All the wallpaper now is being hosted on kde-look.org, which is a great site anyway. If you don't subscribe to their RSS feed, you might want to. It's a great resource for just cool-looking backgrounds and screensavers and things like that. So check them out if you want to, if you need wallpaper. And that is it. Come back soon. We will have more cool Linux tips and tricks and hacks and discussion and stuff like that. The music is, as always, provided by Fat Chance Lester, the mythical legendary band from Midtown, New York City.